For the first time since November, could there finally be a respite in Gaza as warring parties and negotiators shuttle through Cairo? We'll try to see through the smoke screens and the mixed messages if the stars are truly aligning. Beyond a swap of Israeli hostages for Palestinian prisoners, it's tough at face value to comprehend indirect talks between two sides whose official line is the elimination of the other, as the likes of the visiting U.S. Secretary of State hint at a grand bargain from which a truce graduates into a full-blown rewrite of 75 years of Israeli-Palestinian relations. The first step would be a ceasefire. And as interested third parties like the U.S. and Egypt feel the pressure over a war that's in its seventh month, what do they do to help get a deal over the line? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about the chances of a truce. With us from Jerusalem, he's a former negotiator with Hamas, columnist Gershon Baskin. He's also Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
From Washington, Nancy O'Kyle, President and CEO of the Center for International Policy Think Tank. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
From London, former diplomat Nicholas Westcott, Professor of Practice and Diplomacy at SOAS, University of London, will be joining us shortly. And France 24 Jerusalem correspondent Iris Mockler. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24debate. Before Iris, you give us the latest snapshot on negotiations, a look at, well, who's pressuring who. For Israel's prime minister, it's about shoring up his far-right coalition while at the same time addressing the heat from moderates who want the remaining hostages home. Caris Garland has that story.
In large letters laid out on the street, their message is clear. Rafah can wait, hostages cannot. Marking the last day of Passover, hundreds of Israelis took to the streets in Tel Aviv, intensifying pressure on the government to secure the release of captives in Gaza.
We are sick of this government. We are sick of the whole process. We want a hostage deal now. We want the hostages back home. Hamas should also go forward and make a deal. Aren't they sick of what happens to their people?
Protesters have their hopes pinned on a new ceasefire proposal that Hamas is now mulling over. According to several sources, the deal would require the Palestinian militants to release some 30 hostages, and in return, Israel would suspend its planned ground offensive in Rafah and release 1,000 Palestinians from Israeli jails. If the deal's accepted, there will be a ceasefire for 40 days, allowing for the safe entry of more humanitarian aid. After talks in Cairo, Washington says it's hopeful Hamas will agree.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide, and they have to decide quickly.
On Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden held phone calls with his Egyptian counterpart and the Qatari emir, urging them to exert all efforts towards freeing hostages. He said their release was now the only obstacle to an immediate ceasefire.
Iris Mockler, those truce talks in Cairo, we've seen this flurry of back and forth in the last week. How close are we?
That's the question everyone is asking, and the answer is we don't know. I have just seen someone on Israeli TV who's very well connected in Egypt suggesting that Yahya Sinwar has seen, that's the Hamas leader in Gaza, he has seen the proposal and he said what he thinks, which is that it's good but not good enough, and that's being sent back to Egypt. What we know from the Israeli side is that they haven't sent negotiators yet. They're waiting to see what the Hamas response will be. And in Israel, the feeling is it's either a deal or a Rafah military operation. That's what I hear repeated over and over. And perhaps that doesn't worry Yahya Sinwar as much, even though from the reports I've been reading, it does worry the Palestinian population of Gaza very much.
Gershon Baskin, the last time there was a truce, it was November. It lasted 1 week. Did you think at the time that there would be fighting all the way to May Day?
Well, it's impossible to imagine that we are still almost 7 months into this war with 133 Israeli hostages still in Gaza and about 40,000 Palestinians dead, a majority of them women and children. This is just horrendous and horrific in every term of thinking about this world that we're living in land. There has to be a truce. We have to have this war ended. The hostages have to come home, and we need a political solution that's going to move us out of this conflict that we've been in for too long. Israelis and Palestinians have been killing each other for more than 100 years, and this should be the end. This should be the final battle between these two people. But we have a government in Israel that refuses to put a political plan on the table. We have a prime minister who's interested in prolonging the war because it prolongs his own lifetime in office. And we have a very difficult Hamas government in Gaza, which is underground and seems not to care very much about the welfare of its people. This is how it appears right now, and we may be on the cusp of an agreement, but it's still very iffy if we're going to get there.
Why is it that the stars could iffily possibly align now?
Well, there was extreme Egyptian pressure on the Israeli side. The Egyptian Central Intelligence team was here in Israel for 3 days. This is unprecedented. They stayed over for 3 nights in Israel and worked with the Israeli negotiating team and the Israeli war cabinet. They got the Israeli agreement on terms that Israel was not agreeing to before, mainly on the issue of free movement for Palestinians within the Gaza Strip, that Israel would enable and perhaps even facilitate. This was a sticking point. And now the Egyptians are working on putting the pressure on Hamas. I think that we heard from Secretary Blinken is also American pressure on Hamas, and everyone is waiting to see if Hamas is going to give in on what has been its central demand, which is an Israeli commitment to end the war. Unfortunately, we're talking about a limited number of hostages. I think this is an error. The negotiators should have brought forth a deal that would have brought all the hostages out, but that would require Israel to agree to end the war, and they're not yet ready to do that.
Nancy O'Kyle, interesting listening to Gershon there. In your view, how much influence does Egypt have? How much leverage does it have when it comes to Israel and when it comes to Hamas?
For the first time last week, President Sisi himself said that Rafah is a red line and even alluded to how this will be a threat to the peace treaty. And these were like very strong words. I mean, they were vocal by other Egyptian officials in the past, but this is the time when Sisi is actually speaking out, realizing what a Rafah invasion would entail. It will be a huge political cost as well as a huge security cost for Egypt and for Sisi himself. So it is more of what is at stake for Egypt. I mean, I think President Sisi has communicated this repeatedly to the United States and repeatedly to the Israeli government. Right now, it's the space where both Hamas and Israeli officials have come to the table, realizing that at the moment, both Hamas and Israel and other countries around the world, I mean, it's a total loss for everyone. There's no big winner over here. And the realization of the continuation of the loss is what's actually drawing people back to the table, particularly this time the representatives of Hamas went in with a hope to get a deal. They presented some concessions, even in the numbers, going from the prisoners and hostage chains went from 1 to 200, and then 1 to 100, and then 1 to 50. And that's an indication to the level of concessions that they're willing to take. On the other side, I mean, again, Israel, the representatives from Israel were going to Egypt with an authorization to reach a deal. However, we have a split in Israel itself, where you see the far right, as Gershon said, is like calling for continuation of the war and the total destruction of Gaza and all the variations of peace. And you also, but at the same time, you have a pressure from the people who are not seeing any results or any progress after.
Yeah, pressure from two sides. Nancy, we're going to try to reconnect with you because the audio seems to be dipping out. Apologies for that. We're going to try to fix that as soon as possible. You mentioned there the Israeli Prime Minister taking the heat but wanting to hang on this Tuesday. Benjamin Netanyahu telling a meeting with families of fallen soldiers that come hell or high water, the army is going to take Rafah. Later, he issued a video statement.
"We will enter Rafah because we have no other choice. We will destroy Hamas battalions there and we will complete all the objectives of the war, including the repatriation of our abductees."
Now, that's in contrast to what Netanyahu's foreign minister told Israeli television station Channel 12 on Saturday.
"The release of hostages is a top priority for us, the female and male hostages. If there is a deal, we will do a deal."
"Even if it means putting off plans for Rafah?"
"Yes."
"To put off the planned operation in Rafah to step up the deal?"
"If there is a deal, we will halt the operation. We will do whatever is required to bring the hostages back."
Iris Makler, which one is it?
Well, that's a very good question. Perhaps on some level it's both, because Netanyahu has two audiences in mind. One is the people carrying out the negotiations and the families of the hostages, and the greater and greater numbers of the Israeli public turning out every Saturday night for the protests, now linking two groups, you know, hostages now, elections now. So there's that public who want the hostages back, who say an operation in Rafah can wait, but the hostages can't. And then there's his right-wing voters and the right-wing, the far-right members of his coalition government. Two leaders have come out today and said, no, there must be an operation in Rafah. Nothing should stop that, and threatening that they would leave the government. I heard the opposition leader saying, "How ridiculous is this? The tail is wagging the dog," and Netanyahu simply jumps when these right-wing partners tell him what to do instead of them being junior members of his government. So you can see a range of people that Netanyahu is speaking to. It can get confusing, certainly if you're outside the country, but also if you're inside the country, because it depends who he's talking to, what you hear, actually.
Yeah, Gershon Baskett, very quickly on this. Was Benjamin Netanyahu playing to the gallery? Remember that clip we just heard of the foreign minister was from last Saturday. Did he give the game away by saying, "No, actually, if there's a deal, we won't go to Rafah"?
No, I think, look, the army has called up reserves in preparation for the incursion into Rafah. And Netanyahu is holding firm to the statement that he made that there will be an attack into Rafah. I look at this more as a negotiating tactic, but we have to understand a threat is only good if you intend to carry it out. If it's an empty threat, then the other side knows it as well. And one of the concerns of Hamas is certainly to avoid the incursion into Rafah, where there are 1.5 million Palestinians crowded in. It would be disastrous and catastrophic. And I think that the region, King Abdullah in Jordan and President Assisi and the Saudis and the Emiratis and the Bahrainis and the Qataris and everyone wants to avoid this incursion into Rafah. So I think we have to relate to it as a real possibility that Israel will do it if there is no deal. The best way to avoid it is having a deal, having a ceasefire, having the hostages begin to come home.
Nicholas Westcott, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate. And apologies for the technical issues we had in London at the outset there. We just saw a moment ago images of Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, landing in Israel. The Biden administration, which has repeatedly said, don't invade Rafah, it's going to create a humanitarian disaster without a plan for evacuation. Don't go into Rafah. Don't do a ground operation in that haste. If, as Gershon Baskin says, they're making preparations for it and they do carry it out, what does Joe Biden do then?
I think we have to realize that the geostrategic situation has changed significantly since the exchange of attacks between Israel and Iran, because hitherto Israel felt it could live within a relatively secure bubble under the US umbrella, it now realizes it is dependent on its Arab neighbors to help as well in protect it from Iran. That changes the leverage that the US has. And therefore, this acceleration of the negotiations for a ceasefire, Blinken's presence again, is to try and increase pressure on the Netanyahu government. And in Israel itself, the ground is beginning to move under Netanyahu's feet. But he is still there. And for him, continuing the conflict in Gaza is essential for his political survival. So the US are facing a brick wall in that Netanyahu will not sign up to a ceasefire deal unless he feels he has got at least one of his war aims to get all the hostages back. But he set himself unachievable aims in destroying Hamas and getting all the hostages back. And he's having to face that reality. Blinken is there to help him face that reality.
So you're saying because of the fact that you've had this tit-for-tat direct confrontation between Israel and Iran, that other regional players have more leverage. Explain.
Because when Iran attacked, Israel relied to some extent on intelligence and in some cases intervention from the Arab countries around it, particularly Jordan and to some extent others in terms of the intelligence they got, to ward off that attack successfully. And therefore, to some extent, the way that they are dependent on their Arab neighbours as well as on the US umbrella has become clearer. And it has also had an impact on Arab governments themselves. We saw, as you were saying, that President al-Sisi has got tougher. And that's because he is under pressure from his public opinion, from the street, to deliver something, avoid the Palestinians being forced into Egypt. So Israel is under more pressure and is more susceptible to leverage from those Arab neighbors than it was before. And the US is building on that, working with the Arab neighbors. They still have a significant obstacle, but the US leader of the Senate, the Democrat, has himself said, you know, it is time for Netanyahu to go. And that chimes with the protests demanding elections now in Israel. The question is how long Netanyahu can stave that off. And part of his means of staving that off is saying the war must go on.
Nancy O'Kyle, they were writing Benjamin Netanyahu's political obituary on October the 8th. He's still there.
Well, I mean, he is still there.
He is the great survivor.
Nancy O'Kyle.
Yeah, I mean, he's still there because he is using all the tools he has to maintain the war, which is connected to his lifeline in the office. He understands very well that if this war ends, he will no longer be in office, let alone, I mean, the legal consequences that he is going to face. I mean, he continues to raise the voice or support the voice of or even play on the right-wing extremists in Israel. But at the same time, this can only go for so long, particularly given what the Israeli population are seeing, given that seeing that there is a proof of concept that when there was truce, only positive results came out and hostages came back. And at the same time, also, even economically, the country is getting hurt for the second time on April 19th due to the escalation with Iran. Standard & Poor lowered the long-term credit rating of Israel. That comes after 3 months when Moody's did the same. So these are all factors that is creating a lot of pressure on him. He continues to play the card of the destruction of Hamas and ending that. But I think also people understand that this war and this conflict is not only a conflict that can have a military solution, that at the end of the day, they will have to reach a political solution for that.
Antony Blinken, starting the week in Saudi Arabia, there the U.S. Secretary of State met with the Crown Prince and also attended a foreign minister's conference where he talked up a grand bargain, Palestinian statehood in exchange for normalization of ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The work that Saudi Arabia and the United States have been doing together in terms of our own agreements, I think, is potentially very close to completion. But then, in order to move forward with normalization, two things will be required: calm in Gaza and a credible pathway to a Palestinian state. To the extent we finish our work between us, then I think what's been a hypothetical or a theoretical question suddenly becomes real, and people will have to make decisions.
Interesting, Nancy O'Kyle, in that clip, he talks about calm in Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, what Secretary Blinken is reflecting of the U.S. policy since the beginning of the war, where there is a huge gap and disconnect between rhetoric and policy. If we want calm in Gaza, then we stop aiding and supporting and sending arms to Israel. I mean, you cannot say that Rafah is a red line, and you cannot say we want calm in Gaza, but continue to arm Israel, even at the risk of breaking U.S. laws, because by law, if Israel is violating international humanitarian law, that aid should be suspended to Israel. And next month, they are going to be in a more difficult situation where the administration has to report to Congress according to the National Security Memorandum that the president issued in February on whether Israel is violating international humanitarian law and human rights in its conflict. And of course, I mean, there is enough evidence and public evidence from credible organizations that shows all those violations. So this is one thing. The other thing, I mean, if we are optimistic about the U.S. supporting a political solution, you cannot go to the same framework that actually led to the current situation, which is some cosmetic deals with Israel that does not really give real rights and self-determination to the Palestinian people. The putting on the table the recognition of a Palestinian state as a label is not going to do anything. So without real recognition that includes what it means to have a sovereign state, and what boundaries are there, and more importantly, what are the milestones? You cannot have just a general promise in a deal and expect that this will have an impact on a lasting peace.
All right, let's address first point one of what you said there. By the way, the U.S. State Department Monday stating it's found 5 units of the Israeli military responsible for gross violations of human rights, but it's still in conversations with the government of Israel before imposing sanctions. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency reports this Tuesday that prosecutors from the International Criminal Court have interviewed staff from Gaza's 2 biggest hospitals. That's the first confirmation that the ICC is building a case, fueling speculation of an arrest warrant against Israeli government officials. On that score, the U.S. reminding reporters it does not recognize the ICC.
Since this president has come into office, we have worked to reset our relationship with the ICC, and we are in contact with the court on a range of issues, including in connection to the court's important work on Darfur, on Ukraine, on Sudan as well. But on this investigation, our position is clear. We continue to believe that the ICC does not have jurisdiction over the Palestinian situation.
Nicholas Westcott, how's that sitting for the rest of the world? The United States that a la carte recognizes or not files that the ICC is working on.
For most of the members of the EU and the UK, they are members of the ICC. And I believe a legal case is already underway in the UK to challenge the British government in continuing to supply arms to Israel in the light of these potential contraventions of international humanitarian law, which is a requirement that they are respected for British arms exports. So if the ICC takes up this case, and the UK, the EU have encouraged it to gather evidence on the situation in Syria, even though Syria is not a member of the ICC, Ukraine, even though Russia has also not been a member, but the ICC has the capability and indeed the role to collect evidence even in cases where the countries concerned may not be members. What then happens, whether it proceeds to a legal case, remains to be seen. But it will be difficult for those countries that are members of the ICC and respect its jurisdiction if it comes out with accusations of contravention of international humanitarian law and they are still selling arms to Israel. That would be a significant political problem.
Iris Makler, does the Prime Minister of Israel care about the ICC?
Apparently, yes. So all the newspapers tell me. There's descriptions from journalists, from Israeli journalists, about panic inside the Prime Minister's office when he realised that actually he personally could be subject to one of those ICC orders, which would mean that if he landed in a European capital of a country that did recognise or is part of the International Criminal Court, then they would have to arrest him and take him off. So that thought that he himself would personally have to pay a price has apparently, so Israeli journalists tell us, it really does rankle with him. And it might also be, there's some speculation, another of the factors that has gone into this change of Israeli position on a hostage deal and a ceasefire now.
What is, Gershon Baskin, what's changing the equation? Is it the ICC? Is it the pressure we mentioned at the outset with the Egyptians and that have been stepping up their diplomacy? The fact, as you heard Nicholas Westcott say, about how Iran changes the equation?
I think it's all of that, and it's also the pressure coming from within Israeli society, both within the military and the national security establishment and from the street. In particular, the families of the hostages who can't believe that we're almost 7 months into this war and their loved ones are still in Gaza. There's a belief that probably a majority of the hostages are no longer alive, and every day they stay in Gaza is a risk to their lives. This is part of the ethos of Israel, that we don't leave anyone behind, and that ethos is being challenged by Mr. Netanyahu and his government of putting the priority of the war effort before the priority of bringing home the hostages. And this is a breaking point for Israeli society, as many Israelis see it. And I think it's why two-thirds of Israelis today want elections to take place in this year, in 2024. There is a small majority of those who believe we should wait until the end of the war. But more and more Israelis are beginning to understand that there is no end of the war in sight as long as Netanyahu is the prime minister. So we're going to see mounting public pressure, I believe, on pushing for a deal and pushing for elections in Israel. And this is the change that we need to see happen. It should have happened months ago. It's happening now.
And if we get to the second point of what Nancy Okai was talking about, is it just a truce or is it a truce and something more? At that conference in Saudi Arabia, the foreign minister putting an updated bilateral defense deal with Washington in the mix of what happens in the broader region.
Right. And I think in addition to that, what we saw as a result of the Iranian attack on Israel was a regional security alliance that was built to push back those rockets that were sent and missiles that were sent on Israel. And this is an important component of any future arrangement, because what we need to think about is a regional architecture of security and stability and economic development. I would not discount the importance of the recognition of the state of Palestine. There are 139 countries out of the 193 member states of the UN that recognize the state of Palestine, but most of the OECD countries have not. And I think that what happened in the Security Council last week with the US veto was directly against the interest of the United States. I think after 30 years of talking about a two-state solution, it's time to begin to make that two-state solution real. And that happens by recognizing the state of Palestine, granting it membership in the United Nations. I would call for all the countries that don't recognize the state of Israel to do the same and to support a two-state solution in that way. That does not end the Israeli occupation over Palestine, but it does change the parameters of the negotiations when they do get back to the table, hopefully in a regional framework.
Nancy O'Kyle, you mentioned the pressure earlier on Egypt's president from his own population over the fact that the war has dragged on so long. Yet, not just Egypt and Jordan, but the countries that recently normalized ties with Israel, they haven't gone back on that.
Well, I mean, let's remember one thing that, I mean, the countries that had normalization with Israel were not at war with Israel to begin with, as opposed to other countries, like, for example, like Egypt. However, I mean, any movement right now to either direction puts those presidents at risk. Of course, I mean, there is pressure from the people on the relationship and revising and revisiting the relationship of Arab states with Israel. But at the same time, let's not forget that these are not particularly democratic countries where you can easily change the course of the direction of the presidency. Of course, it represents a risk. However, I mean, it's not really in the same way that could change the opinion in other countries or the direction of other countries. Although, speaking of which, I mean, the United States supposedly is like this democratic country with stable institutions. We are seeing a lot of violations, and we're seeing a lot of resistance to what people are seeing. If you just like Gershon mentioned the ICC, but also it's not just the ICC, it's the ICC, the NSC, the protests on campuses. We just heard some news that Germany might be also suspending arms to Israel, yet to be confirmed. So all this is like creating a global pressure that includes both the Arab leaders and European leaders and the U.S. So, and it's not getting better. It is that we are seeing right now 40,000 deaths in Gaza. And even if the war stops right now or there's like a cessation of hostilities, the summer is coming, and given that the social system in Gaza had been like broken, and that increases contamination, which even increases more with the heat, and that's going to create a catastrophic disease spread and contamination and more deaths, even if the fighting stops. The world is watching that, and all populations, not just the Arab population. We're seeing the solidarities across campuses in the United States and elsewhere in the world.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Because while Gaza burns, Washington's military support for Israel is tearing apart Joe Biden's base in this, an election year in the United States. Here you see images overnight of students who occupied Columbia University's Hamilton Hall. This is on the main New York City campus for them. Now, Gershon Baskin, Iris Mockler and I were speaking with former State Department official Aaron David Miller on Monday, and he warns that if the third parties like Egypt, like the United States, are feeling the heat, well, that could be a recipe for the likes of Israel and Hamas to harden their positions, not soften them when it comes to these negotiations. Your thoughts?
It might be right. I mean, there's no way of knowing right now. It seems to me that it might go the other way. In fact, this war needs to come to an end. It's very questionable whether or not, in fact, it's not questionable. Israel cannot achieve the military effort of destroying Hamas. Hamas will not be destroyed militarily. It can only be destroyed politically. That's by offering the Palestinian people freedom and liberation and hope. Palestinians need to know that if they are going to get freedom and liberation, Israel has to get security. This is the equation here. Israelis won't have security if Palestinians don't have hope in liberation. Palestinians won't have hope in liberation if Israelis don't have security. And this is the way that the entire world, we all need to push these two sides forward. We need to push the Israeli government to recognize that they need to put a political plan on the table. And Hamas has to know that it is not going to continue to control Gaza. I think they know this already. There are talks going on between the various Palestinian factions and personalities on what will replace Hamas in Gaza. As I said before, this needs to be the final battle.
So, but Gershon, just let me ask you, because after the Oslo Accords in the early 90s, it just dragged on, and then it started to fall apart, and then it did fall apart. It was a matter of years. You're saying that now we have a possibility of suddenly going from what is right now a horrible situation to an actual peace deal?
Look, we need to recognize that whereas most of the international community used to say the Israelis and the Palestinians have to want it more than us, that's no longer the reality here. This conflict has gone beyond the borders of Israel and Palestine. It affects the security of the region. It affects global shipping. It can expand into a regional and global war. It is not just the concern of Israelis and Palestinians anymore. It is an international concern, and it has to be based on regional changes that will take place. We have the opportunity for those changes, both because of the Saudi position and its desire to have the security alignment with the United States and normalization with Israel. The price for Israel is going to have to be to recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination. No more 30 years about talking about a solution. Let's not forget also that the Oslo process also failed because the Israeli prime minister was assassinated by someone from within our own society who was against this process from taking place. We have radicals on both sides of this conflict who will seek to destroy it, and we need to stand firm and maintain the decision that we must move forward into a genuine.
In light of all that, Gershon, is there a reluctant warrior like Yitzhak Rabin who can step forward? Does that exist?
It doesn't exist right now, as we see on the Israeli political arena, but there are going to be a new generation of leaders in Israel and in Palestine around the region who are going to stand up and begin to look forward and not only backwards. We won't forget what they did to us. We will always remember. It's part of our narrative. But we need our young generation, our young people, to begin to look forward and say this can't go on. 7 million Israeli Jews, 7 million Palestinian Arabs living between the river and the sea who are not going anywhere. We have to figure this out.
Nicholas Westcott, your thoughts sitting by the banks of the River Thames of what's going on in the United States. The UK is headed towards a general election. And we saw that the Labour Party, even though it's slated for a big win, tore itself apart a few years back over domestic issues when it came to anti-Semitism. Are you feeling a similar kind of divisive vibe when it comes to 7 months of war in Gaza? Is that being felt in the UK on campuses, for instance?
The situation is not as bad as in the US here, but it does remain a sensitive political issue for both the Conservative and the Labour Party. As you said, the Labour Party had a serious problem with internal anti-Semitism, against which Keir Starmer has set his face and has taken perhaps a more pro-Israeli position than he might otherwise have done to demonstrate that the Labour Party is no longer anti-Semitic in any way. But when should he come into power, he will have to deal with the realities on the ground. And what Gershon has said is absolutely true. There are 14 million people living in that space. They have to find a way to live peacefully together. It won't happen under the existing leadership of Hamas nor of the Israeli government. So there has to be a change of leadership on both sides. And the international community will have to help that happen, provide support for a potential solution to ensure that the maximum pressure is brought on both sides to find a peaceful solution, not a military one. And that will face whatever government comes to power after our elections here, and they need to play a constructive role, not a partisan role, in supporting a peace process.
Iris Makler, you heard Gershon stating that it is going to take outside pressure. But is public opinion moving, or is it just impossible to gauge it really as long as the fighting continues?
I think it is very hard to gauge as long as the fighting continues and as long as the hostages are still held in Gaza. In a way, that doesn't let Israelis get over the horrendous attack of October the 7th. It stays alive because those people were taken from their homes and filmed. You know, the only evidence that we have really of it is actually the GoPro cameras of the Hamas operatives themselves. And that's a wound that doesn't heal here. And I don't think will heal until the hostages are returned. So if you look a few months down the line, let's say this hostage deal does somehow, or some version of it does take place, and there's a ceasefire, and there's an international reassessment. I was interested in what Gershon said about the impact of and the Iranian impact. And I guess in that one night of the Iranian attack, a new alliance was born in a way. So Israel actually has to pay attention to that. And that's what Antony Blinken has been saying in Saudi Arabia. And that's what he's coming here to say as well, to dangle a diplomatic opportunity, to dangle perhaps a recognition from Saudi Arabia in front of Israel and in front of a Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has worked towards this for years. So can he say yes? Can he say no? All of those things are here together to push this public to a new place because the old place is becoming unlivable.
Iris Makler in Jerusalem, many thanks. I want to thank as well Gershon Baskin, Nancy O'Kyle for joining us from Washington, Nicholas Westcott in London. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.